Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo Is There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest this time is a returning guest, Olav Rockne, and we are going to be discussing Where Late the Sweet Birds Sang by Kate Wilhelm, which won the 1977 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So, Olav, thanks for joining me again.
Thanks for having me. Thrilled to be here.
All right. So, I mean, since you're a returning guest, we don't have to recapitulate the whole history of your nerdery, but anything new with the Hugo Club?
No. We're continuing to read books. Currently, Gideon the Ninth is our next one by Tamsin Muir. That's we're going to be reading that in between now and I think our meeting is on April 9th. The blog continues to roll along. The Hugo nomination ballots went in on Friday. I think 2020's Hugos are going to be a particularly strong batch. There's about 10 novels that I would be really happy to see on the shortlist. The novels are really strong this year. Just overall, it's a really good crop, I think.
Nice. Well, the other thing, we should probably just tell people a little bit about the Hugo Club, just in case they're in your area.
Oh, well, it's basically a group of my friends and I who got together around 2014-15 when the Sad Puppies thing was going on. Because we didn't like the hijacking of the Hugos, we decided to get involved with nominating and voting, and making informed choices meant reading a lot of the science fiction that was either on the ballot or likely to be on the ballot. Then we just started blogging about it. So it's, we're open to random people contacting us and becoming a part of the club. Best accessed through the Twitter handle at Hugo_book_club. It's based in Edmonton, Alberta. That's basically what it is.
So why this book, Olav?
Well, actually, can I start by asking you a question?
Sure.
Had you ever heard of this book before you started looking at the Hugo winners?
No, I had not.
And neither had I.
Okay.
That kind of explains what drew me to talking about this book, because when I started really getting into science fiction, I hadn't heard of Kate Wilhelm. I think it would have taken me a lot longer to hear of Kate Wilhelm if I hadn't seen this one on that list of Hugo winners. And it's a superb novel. Right. It's a really good novel that I don't feel gets talked about as much as some of the other Hugo winners. You know, you ask somebody their favorite science fiction novels or to talk about which Hugo winners they love, and generally the same half dozen books are in the conversation every time. And when you ask people which Hugo winners didn't deserve the award or which books they think are overrated, there's often several books that show up. This book doesn't show up in either of those lists. And it doesn't seem to be a part of the broader conversation of science fiction quite as much as many other Hugo winners. I don't think I'd have to double check this, but I don't even think Kate Wilhelm was ever shortlisted for the best novel Hugo before or after this.
Okay.
I think she only has one or two short story or novelette shortlistings to boot. Like she's not the perennial Hugo contender.
Right.
So it's just neat that this book won out of a short list that included, you know, Frederick Pohl, who's, of course, a legendary figure. I believe Shadrach in the Furnace by Silverberg was on the short list.
Yes.
What? He's got how many novels that were shortlisted over his career?
Quite a few.
Oh, quite a few. It was a pretty stacked Hugo ballot. With some really great books, and this one pulled off a narrow win. From what I understand, second place was Man Plus by Frederick Pohl. And there were cultural arguments going on within the Hugo community at the time between sort of the old guard, the very traditionalist, very Campbellian crowd, and that upstart new wave social science fiction oriented crowd. So the fact that Kate Wilhelm won was part of a similar cultural discussion as the 2015 Sad Puppies debacle.
Hmm.
And with the light of 44 years of hindsight, I think this is a choice that holds up remarkably well. It's a book that reads in a very modern way. It's a book whose gender politics is at times troubling, but also is very forward-looking in some parts. I mean, the depictions of same-sex relationships as being relatively unremarkable fits in very well today. So it's a book that I think has held up very well over 44 years. I think it's a remarkably well-written book, just on a sentence-by-sentence prose. I think it might be one of the best written Hugo winners of all.
Wow.
Just Kate Wilhelm is such a superb sentence by sentence prose writer. These varied sentence lengths, these really interesting word choices, but interesting and appropriate, like susurrations and these really superb vocabulary choices. I think there's something like 24 different words used to describe leaves in this book, and several dozen different tree species that are mentioned and described. It's that precision of language and that level of detail that makes it a delight to read. And then it has so much to say about the dangers of monoculture. And not just biological monoculture, but cultural homogeneity.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I kind of love this book. And I don't think I would have read it if it hadn't I certainly wouldn't have read it as early as I did, if not for the Hugo Award.
Yeah, and I wouldn't have read it at all, I'm sure. Like we hinted earlier, it came onto my radar just because it's one of the Hugo winners.
And, I mean, Kate Wilhelm founded the Clarion Workshop. She did a lot in the science fiction community. But for some reason, she doesn't have the same stature as a Le Guin, as a Orson Scott Card, or as a Heinlein. She isn't part of that everyday conversation of science fiction. She's very well known amongst fans because, of course, her husband Damon Knight, and she did those, what were they called, the Orbit anthologies in the 60s and 70s?
Mm-hmm.
And this even started as a novella in one of those anthologies.
Right.
The first third of the book was that novella.
Yeah.
Now, you liked the book, did you?
I did, yeah. I was going to move into kind of overall thoughts and, non-spoiler synopsis. Maybe we should do that first, the non-spoiler synopsis. Do you want to take that?
I can take that. The book is, it takes place over the course of several decades, probably 70 or 80 years, from the time when a variety of ecological catastrophes and a plague scour the earth of humanity by and large. So in that first section of the book, we follow a character named David, who's a young medical researcher who I believe he went to Yale, and he comes back to his family's farm in a valley in Virginia, in rural Virginia. And his uncle has been preparing for this apocalypse, fairly standard setup here. A small community of survivors is rebuilding after the fall of civilization. But the plague and ecological catastrophe has caused widespread sterility.
Right.
So David and Walt, his relative, begin cloning a new generation. Subsequently, this new generation takes control of society. The young up-and-comers, they displace their elders and form a society of clones where essentially they don't intend to breed new people, just clone additional copies of the right. same handful of archetypes. Mm-hmm. So David ends up being banished for trying to stop the clones, and it then skips ahead several decades to a character named Molly, who is one of the clones of David's wife or lover, Celia.
Yeah.
So Molly and a few other clones are sent on an expedition to Washington. And this is one of my favorite portions of the book, where they go down the river to the ruins of Washington, D.C. to see what has become of the rest of the world. And they find that they are disconnected from their community, and it really troubles them. They can't deal with the isolation. As clones, they have formed very strong, almost supernatural bonds with their clone mates. Mm-hmm. And so their voyage back is very fraught. And by the time she gets back to the clone civilization, Molly has broken from the collective. Mm-hmm. And this causes a rift between her and the rest of the community. And over several chapters, she realizes she can no longer be a part of that society and goes to live on her own. Mm-hmm. So one of the other people she went to Washington with was a clone whose name I forget. Was it David?
Ben.
Ben, thank you. Ben and she conceive a child in secret, and that child grows up to be Mark. And in the last section of the book, Mark has been studied by the clones as the only individual, because they want to learn what humanity used to be like.
Right.
But by this point, clone society has begun to break down because they don't have the creativity or the diversity of thought to solve the problems that they had, and they're losing the ability to clone new generations. So Mark abandons the clones, kidnaps a number of women, and begins setting up a breeder-based society anew. And that's sort of where the book ends, with the breeders thriving and the clone society failing.
Yeah.
And it's remarkably short. It's something like 200 pages. So 200 pages that cover 70 to 100 years worth of time. It does feel a little rapid fire at times, and you lose track of characters who will disappear. I mean, I think that David, once he gets exiled, we never actually find out how he lived out the rest of his life.
Right.
So that is a slight criticism I'll have of the book. Mm-hmm. And some of the scenes of the forced breeding of women are difficult, challenging.
Yes. Yeah, and I think that's as intended.
Yes.
Yeah, so I mean, so that was a great overview. Not super non-spoiler, but I don't feel like this is a book that is easy to really spoil the experience of reading. Like you said, it's a short one. It's a quick read. I really enjoyed it. And we were talking before we started recording that some of the kind of the lead ups to the apocalypse in the book are very almost shockingly relevant today with the coronavirus pandemic, just in case I don't release this before it just magically disappears. But especially the kind of slow and half-witted response of the government to it. And you had mentioned that you had a quote from the book about that.
Yes. The quote is from early in the book, around the 20th page, I want to say. The government had to admit the seriousness of the coming catastrophe, had to take strict measures to avert it, or at least alleviate it. But instead, the government chose to paint glowing pictures of the coming upturn that would be apparent by fall. During the next 6 months, those with sense and money would buy everything they could to see them through, because after that period of grace, there would be nothing to buy. Mm-hmm. I didn't pick this book trying to be relevant. I just want to put it out there. I had chosen this book as one to talk about long before coronavirus was really hitting
any of our radars.
Wild. Yeah, you had actually mentioned it in our previous episode.
Yeah, it's long been a favorite of mine.
Yeah. Well, what about some comps for this book? I actually have kind of a long list of comps for it.
The two that spring to mind for me are Earth Abides by George R. Stewart, which follows the structure pretty closely, and The Death of Grass by John Christopher.
Okay.
Have you read either of those?
I haven't. I've heard of both of them, but I haven't read them.
What would your comps be?
Well, I had a couple comps that were just kind of thematic comps or like some of the setup. So a book like Alas, Babylon, which is a nuclear post-apocalypse in Florida. It's kind of, I always say that Alas, Babylon is like the novel version of the short-lived television show Jericho.
Yeah.
It's very similar, where it's just a, you know, a group of people trying to figure out how to survive in the new reality. Another one, Children of Men, just because of the infertility.
Yeah.
And then I also had Never Let Me Go because of the idea of cloning and how are the clones different from humans. That's kind of the existential part of it. And then there's some bits of Brave New World and Animal Farm in it just because of the planned society, the planned economy.
I think those are all very astute observations. None of those are structurally similar, though, in the flipping forwards through time. I would really say that both in terms of language and structure, Earth Abides is incredibly similar because it has the vignette of the main character surviving the apocalypse, a second section where he's helping rebuild society, and then the society doesn't take the shape that he had hoped for it, and eventually there's a generational issue.
Wow.
And it's a great novel. I do recommend it highly.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's been on my list for a while. It's just not one of the Hugo winners.
So. Yeah. It predates the Hugos by some decades. Yeah.
Well, I'll have to keep an eye out for that one because it comes up on some of the BookBub and early books, the ebook sales that I get through email. So I'll have to keep an eye out for that.
Yeah, but, you know, this book, Where Late the Sweet Birds Sang, I mean, it's so elegiac in tone. It's so mournful and wistful.
Yes.
And it's so poetically written. Like, lines like, what impulse had driven them from their own kind to perish alone among strangers? I mean, that's a quality of writing thing that you really don't see in a lot of genre work.
Yeah, it's funny because the title is derived from Shakespeare's Sonnet 73, which is a lovely sonnet. I read it yesterday. And you saying it's kind of elegiac reminds me of just kind of it's a very wistful sonnet. I don't know if you've read it.
I actually haven't. Okay. Do you have it there?
Let's see. I have Mr. Google. So yeah, just the first few lines of it, right? That time of year thou mayest in me behold, when yellow leaves or none or few do hang upon those boughs which shake against the cold, bare ruined choirs where late the sweet birds sang. That's the first four lines of it. You know, it's talking about the change of season. And that's definitely a factor in this book, right? About preparations for, and I guess there's some environmental change that happens, right?
Yes. Well, there's huge environmental change. It starts off with there's radiation on top of the plague. So I think the sterility is caused by multiple factors, but it doesn't just affect humans. So it's very literally the sweet birds used to sing in this book, and now there's this eerie quiet across the land. And there's this great scene in, again, that section about Molly going to Washington, where they discover that fish have survived, and that is just greeted with such wonder and joy. They've never seen fish before.
Right.
These themes around collective good versus individual need, the themes around homogeneity of thinking and the dangers of casting out all those who disagree with you slightly, you know, they are so resonant across the decades. Like,
yes,
it's a really, I think, timeless book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, even, in the workplace, there's lots of companies have diversity initiatives in them. And one of the things that they teach you in those is that groups of very, very homogeneous groups tend to think, well, because we are all alike, we'll be more efficient. But it doesn't end up being the case that you actually are more efficient when you have disagreement, when you have multiple points of view represented. And so it's absolutely a good thing to make sure that you have a diverse workforce.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting to me that it is so unlike the rest of the Hugo winners by and large, because these aren't themes that are tackled in the same way in many Hugo winners.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a book that fits comfortably into that sequence of winners where it's, Rendezvous with Rama, Gateway, what was the one by Orson Scott Card? I'm blanking on it. Ender's Game. This doesn't fit comfortably in amongst those. Like it is a very unusual Hugo winner. I'm trying to even recall how many Hugo winners are actually post-apocalyptic. And I mean, there's Canticle for Leibowitz, and there's this one. What else is there that's a post-apocalyptic novel that won the Hugo?
I'm looking at the list. You could make an argument for The Man in the High Castle, but I don't think that really fits.
No. Stand on Zanzibar might be a comparable.
Yeah, that's one I haven't read yet, so I don't know. I mean, the fifth season, right? The Broken Earth trilogy is definitely...
It is an apocalyptic novel, but it's not really about an apocalypse of our world in many ways.
Right.
Yeah, it's basically just those two.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, and even when you look at it in the context of the list, right? Rendezvous with Rama, The Dispossessed, The Forever War, Gateway, those are the ones around it. It's very different.
And it's only the third novel by a woman to have won the Hugo, and the first novel by a woman not named Ursula Le Guin.
Right.
But since we're both looking at this list now, it's interesting to note that, as I mentioned, the final two in terms of vote getting on that ballot were Man Plus and Kate Wilhelm's book. From what I understand, they were only separated by a handful of votes. So it was one of the closer Hugo races. And the more traditionalist old guard, of course, preferred Man Plus, even though that's sort of an odd book for the classic science fiction. But Fred Pohl was, first fandom and had been in the community a very long time.
Right.
And Kate Wilhelm from this upstart crowd. But the very next year, Fred Pohl wins with Gateway.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I love both of these books. So it's sort of interesting that they're coming from very different places. And then both having depictions of homosexuality that are positive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is the late 70s. So it's only a few years post Stonewall. It's long before mainstream acceptance of these subjects. And the Hugos are recognizing works that are very, open about this and very progressive in their views.
Yep. So structurally, this book kind of reads like three separate novellas, right? And I some of that comes back to the publication history, because the first novella of it was published in Orbit.
Yes.
Do you know, were the other two published at the same time as the entire volume?
As far as I'm aware, the first publication of the second and third parts were as part of the novel.
Okay.
I could be incorrect about this, but to the best of my knowledge, the Molly section and the Mark section were written for the novel publication.
Mm-hmm.
Have you looked at the cover art for this one?
Yeah, I've looked at a couple different versions of the cover art.
I got to say, I've loved so many of the covers of this one. There's the classic one with the ruins of Washington and the three clones. that was published in the 80s. I just think that's a superb cover. The first one that I had was sort of a greenish cover.
Yeah, that's what I have.
Okay, the sort of thin, was it Del Rey?
I'm not sure, actually. I'm looking at cover art right now. The one I have has the really large trees and the, you know, one tiny person.
Yes. And I think it's interesting because this book is so open to interpretation and involves sections that vary in tone so much that you can really do a lot with the cover. There's, you know, you can have that adventuresome archaeological aspect with the Washington cover. And there's the version of the cover that you have with the tiny person and the huge trees and the themes around isolation. And then you've got the technocratic cover with the hospital and the laboratories along the valley. So it's sort of, I think the covers actually reveal just how many interpretations this book can have.
Yeah.
Like, did you feel that it fit into that greater arc of Hugo winners very well?
I haven't done much of thinking about it in terms of, or about really any of the, what the greater arc is. And that could be just because of going through in more or less random order.
No.
Yeah.
You've read Joe Walton's book, Informal History of the Hugos, right?
I haven't. No.
Okay. So I should say, I haven't looked this up in the print volume, but I remember she blogged about this book when she was doing the series of blogs that eventually became that book. Hmm. And when she was talking about Where Late the Sweet Birds Sang, she mentioned it as something that she'd read many years ago. I had generally positive memories of it, but couldn't really say much about it. And to my mind, this book has that effect on the science fiction reading public. It is generally well-liked by those who have read it, generally well-regarded, but it doesn't elicit passionate responses. And I think that's such a shame because it is so terrifically well-written and so so smart. Like, it is a really smart book. And, you know, Kate Wilhelm just kept up with it. I think her last story was only published in 2018. She passed on relatively recently, right around the same time Ursula Le Guin did. But, you know, she was a terrific force in science fiction and much neglected.
Well, let's kind of start. I think it's probably time we just dive into spoilers.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's definitely a recommend from me. It sounds like it's absolutely a recommend from you on account of being underread and underappreciated.
Very much so. I actually think anyone who's seriously going into reading the Hugos or interested in a history of the genre should place a priority on this one.
Okay. I had divided my notes up into the three portions of the book. So the Where Late the Sweet Birds Sang, and then the second, which is called Shenandoah, and then At the Still Point. There's a lot more incest in this book than I was expecting.
Yes.
And I was thinking about it and thinking, you know, part of the incest taboo is the genetic consequences. I think that the two kind of go hand in hand. And if you're infertile, you know, if everyone is sterile, I guess maybe anything goes. But I thought it was very matter of fact about, you know, that David was in love with his cousin, and the family didn't seem to approve.
No, they didn't. They definitely did not.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that, you know, the cloning was envisioned by David and the others as more or less a stopgap measure, right? We need to be able to continue the species and get to a point where the clones are fertile again. And I think they figured out that it was in the fifth generation that they'd be fertile again.
Yeah. Every generation has its own ideas.
Right.
You know, we can't control what our descendants will do.
Mm-hmm. It reminded me a bit of the Star Trek The Next Generation episode, Up the Long Ladder, where you have, have you seen that one?
If I have, I don't recall it.
So the Enterprise encounters two colonies from either a doomed expedition or I can't remember exactly the setup for it, but one of them is this very kind of probably insultingly Irish, really, if I think about it, group that's technologically somewhat primitive, but they're a pretty healthy colony. And then there's this other one that's much more almost Brave New World, where they have reproduced by cloning, and they're realizing that they're at some point the two colonies need to come back together and in order to increase the genetic diversity. But the group that reproduces by cloning is just repulsed by the idea of sexual reproduction. And that's very similar to what goes on in this book.
It's funny because the clones aren't grossed out by the idea of copulation.
Correct.
Clone siblings are encouraged to do whatever they like with their bodies from as young an age as they feel like it and with whomever and however many.
Right.
It's almost used as a bonding exercise. Mm-hmm. It isn't... I never felt like it was exploitative, though.
Right.
You know, it isn't depicted to titillate. It isn't depicted in a sort of seamy or unseemly manner. It just relatively matter of fact. And I don't, at least my recollection of it is that it doesn't sort of linger on the subject.
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it is more shown as how these generations are different and how society has just gone in different ways than you would expect.
Yes. It's very matter of fact. Just says that I think the term is the getting out the mats.
Yeah.
So evidently there's an element of the game Twister, I guess. but nothing very explicit is actually discussed. But it's the difference here is that the clones have left behind the traditional pair bond that the isolate people go for. And that's brought into sharp relief with Mark, right? When he finally has sex with someone, that he wants to make it an exclusive thing. And I can't remember who it was that was his partner, but she's horrified by that.
Molly and Ben also sort of start moving in that direction late in their story. So I think the pull towards monogamy is definitely a theme that Kate plays with. Mm-hmm. I almost want to see that as a reaction to the science fiction's interest in polyamory during that era. You know, you've got a number of authors who in the 70s are grappling with this, the sexual revolution, and projecting forward this idea that things are only going to become more permissive and only going to become more socially unbound. And Kate Wilhelm is saying, well, no, things can go in multiple directions. Things move in one way and the other, and sometimes the social mores are going to be ones that you and I aren't going to be comfortable with. Mm-hmm. I think that Heinlein certainly played around a lot with polyamory and a lot with promiscuity in his books. And I almost feel like Wilhelm presents a more interesting view of how societies change over time. And she's almost thumbing her nose at Heinlein.
Hmm. Yeah, the fact is that kind of the psychic link between the clones, and this is picked up more in the Shenandoah subsection. Actually, I guess that's where it's first discussed, is the psychic link. You know, it gives kind of an obvious, okay, well, that makes sense that groups that had that kind of metaphysical link between them would see that group as the unit, right, rather than the male-female pair bonding of the traditional family.
I hadn't really thought of that, but yeah, you're definitely right.
But there isn't the objection to mixing of those groups, right? As long as everybody's in on it, which everybody is.
Yeah. So the second section, I mean, what is there to spoil about it that I haven't already?
Right.
They're seeking out new resources by going to Washington. I'm afraid that I did a lot of spoiling already.
Yes.
Sorry about that. But you're right that it isn't a book that can be spoiled very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this one's more about characters and tone than it is about plot.
Yeah, and it's also about themes.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the one thing you can really spoil is that there are these seeds of a new world coming up at the end. And it's not a world that anybody along the way would have said, this is how we're going to rebuild.
Right. You know, Mark, as the individual in that very collective society, becomes aware. And I think even Barry, who's one of the more sympathetic clones, is aware that their society is built on this pyramid. And if the pyramid's foundation starts to crumble, then everything that's built upon it will crumble. And yet, in parallel to that, the clones have figured out how to perfect the cloning process. And they're heading in a direction of cloning different classes of people. And that's where the Animal Farm reference comes in, right? Where it's all animals are created equal, but some are more equal than others.
Yeah, and I think your point about comparing it to Brave New World is really on point.
Yeah.
Especially in that last section, you know.
Yeah.
Mark being the savage or the other in a society of homogeneity.
Yes, definitely.
I gotta say, my least favorite section of the book is that last one.
Okay.
You know, it's fine. It just doesn't speak to me like that first section does, or like the Shenandoah section does.
Okay. No, I did really enjoy that. That was the kind of the quickest read, I think. Maybe the first section was. I don't know. You know, I read it in about a week and didn't particularly try to read it quickly. I enjoyed his. I liked both of the expeditions that we got in the Shenandoah section, where it's the Molly and Ben and some of the others. I liked that, and there was the tension created there was, of course, they're starting to realize that they had lost something in separating from their peers. But I did enjoy. Mark's expedition, his solo expedition, where he goes off in the canoe and tries to explore Philadelphia. And I thought it was emblematic of kind of the difference between him as an individual and the rest of the collective, that when he came back and reported Philadelphia is not approachable, it's radioactive, that, you know, his ideas about that were poo-pooed. And they're like, no, nobody dropped any bombs.
Yeah. Yeah. That is a good point that his approach to it is different, but also, I mean, they don't really want to see Molly's paintings either.
Right.
They don't want to listen to her when she gets back. Mm-hmm. So there is a similarity of approach to some degree.
Yeah. Well, where's the room for art in a society where everyone has to be useful?
Yeah. And it's also interesting how the society becomes very gendered, you know, that in this society of clones, it's the men who do certain types of work in a way that,
right.
That I think a lot of writers were predicting the exact opposite over time.
Mm.
In the 70s, this is written pre Handmaid's Tale, before,
right.
Even before Reagan. So the conservative backlash wasn't even... the conservative backlash to the feminist movement wasn't really getting its full head of steam yet. And yet mm-hmm. Kate Wilhelm is saying, you know, in certain circumstances, we may end up with a lot of backsliding on women's rights.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's exemplified in no better way than with the breeders, right? Because it's not like there's men who are being really oppressed that way.
No, they make it very clear that it was very easy to test for fertility, and male clones who were fertile were treated just like any other male clones.
Mm-hmm.
They just didn't want to breed new generations of individual humans.
Right. I'm trying to think, when they were projecting out their new system for creating the perfect clones, were they still going to keep the breeders around just for extra genetic diversity?
Oh, I thought that they were using the breeders as maybe I've misread this, but I thought my understanding was that the breeders were being used to as wombs where they implanted clones.
Well, they had artificial wombs in the laboratory.
Right, but the artificial wombs couldn't be maintained in perpetuity.
Right, yeah. And so I think moving forward, they were going to implant groups, like triplets, of their new clones.
Right.
In the breeders. And that's when, so Mark is talking to one of the ladies at the breeder facility and saying, how many sets of triplets do you think that you can bear, that can your body handle, when he was trying to convince her to come with him?
Yes.
What do you think about the fact that he drugs the breeders and takes them with him? I mean, he does not give them the agency to say, yes, we want to come with you.
That's one of the key reasons why I find the third portion of the book difficult and why I don't really like it. I find it very hard to cheer for Mark, I guess, right, in part because I'd read the book, you know, the first time I read the book was in the mid 80s. I was probably too young for it. And that stuck with me. And so when I was, you know, I reread it in preparing for this podcast, I guess I always had a visceral antipathy towards Mark because of that. It's not a set of actions that can be condoned.
Yeah, I've been trying to think about this, is there a way to justify it? Because their life is absolutely better in the new society that he creates.
Yeah.
Because they're not just, you know, wombs with legs, like they say in The Handmaid's Tale. But the fact that he didn't, I mean, he gave them a chance, right, to say, yes, we want to come with you. And when they rejected him, then he resorted to, well, this is for your own good. And I think that's the way he would justify it to himself. This is for their own good. They'll thank me later. But it's kind of oogie, you know, to think about enforcing your will and your idea of what's better for someone.
Yeah. I don't think I can condone it.
Yeah.
Their choice, you know, mm-hmm. their choice is sacrosanct to me. And so I can't get on board with Mark. Doesn't matter if it's saving, you know, the species.
Right.
Doesn't matter if you think it's better for someone else. Mm-hmm. You have to make that choice. And there's so much that I find problematic in that Mark section.
Okay. Well, that's what's great about science fiction, right? Is that it brings those kind of questions up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. This is a novel that makes you think. Mm-hmm. It's a novel that has bits of adventure, but it's really not an adventure novel. Mm-hmm. It's not even, I mean, the only, when I think about it, like, there's only really three or four people in the book that I would consider to be reasonably well-developed characters. It's not really a character study. Mm. You know, you get Molly's internal voyage, like, who she is and who she becomes. But David is sort of a static point. Mm-hmm. He is who he is when you meet him. He is the same person when you part company with him. Mm-hmm. His beliefs and attitudes never shifted. And I mean, Molly, it's such a cataclysmic break from who she was to who she becomes. That's not really a progression or an arc. She discovers who she has become, but it's not a slow process of change. Mm-hmm. So on that aspect, while Kate Wilhelm creates these very memorable few protagonists, the book isn't about their character journeys. It's about this social science fiction and these questions of organizing society.
Right. Do you feel like this book could have benefited from being longer?
Oh, definitely. That is something that a number of people have said over the years, actually. It's and it's rare that I would say a book would benefit from being longer because...
Yeah, me too.
I think many books are bloated, but I almost feel like this could have done with the second and third novellas being beefed out, and I almost wouldn't mind a fourth novella sort of saying... what happens next.
Right. There was an epilogue in mine. Is that in all editions?
Yes.
Okay.
But it's so scant.
It is. Yeah.
And I think I've already said that the second portion is my favorite, and mm-hmm. I could have spent a lot more time with Molly.
Yes. I think that was the portion I actually went through the quickest. So that I think that kind of lends to the idea that it was my favorite portion as well. But it may take a reread for me to know that.
Yeah. You know, it's I definitely think this one could have been longer. I can't think of very many novels in the Hugos that were shorter than this one. I know The Big Time is shorter. Mm. But other than that, not counting retro Hugos, I don't think there is a shorter novel to have won.
Hmm. Well, I always like a short book, but I did find that there were times that I thought things could have been better developed, especially stuff like the psychic link. It's kind of hinted at more than developed, because there's not a lot of character viewpoint talking about what it means. There's the notion that after Molly comes back from her voyage, at some point one of her sisters is injured and she doesn't know about it. And that's a shocking thing to them that she didn't know.
Yeah, I think my read of it, the first hint of there being a psychic bond is, I think, when the person gets injured at the mill.
Yes.
And David can't figure out how the clones knew about it already, right?
Right. Yeah.
And when we get the clone perspectives, it seems to me that they never really ask what this link is. It just is, and it isn't so much mm-hmm. an explicit, overt telepathic link as just a sense, a knowledge, it happens with like breathing. Their connection to their clone mates is it's just an awareness.
Yeah.
So I kind of like the fact that it's never spelled out, because how do you convey that?
Sure.
How do you convey that without it becoming very leaden if you're spelling it out to readers?
Right. Yeah, well, it's not like the book is hard science fiction either with the descriptions of cloning, right? There isn't anything in there that talks about the actual process.
No, and there's a lot that you just don't need to spell out, I think, in this book. Hey, now that we talk about the telepathic link, it strikes me that none of the primary point of view characters is experiencing that telepathic link when we are following their stories. I mean, there's a little bit with Molly before she leaves on the river, but then she's on the river and she's completely cut off.
Mm-hmm.
And then when she gets back, she doesn't have that connection. So we're not really dealing with the telepaths in this society as primary point of view characters.
Right. Yeah. I think it's probably time to move into final thoughts on this one.
Yeah. Well, I feel like I have not been very focused on keeping strict boundaries between the sections of this discussion
right.
overall. But that almost works for this novel, because it is not one where there are impermeable boundaries. It's all
right.
very experiential. It's mm-hmm. it's a great work of art. It deserved the Hugo more than a lot of books do. I think it's one of the handful of truly brilliantly well-written books to have won the Hugo. It's the prose is masterful. The ideas are very strong and very prescient. I think some Hugo winners are a book of their time.
Mm-hmm.
Some fade over time. This is a book of its time. It's definitely a book of the 1970s. There will be times you'll be like, yeah, this was written in the 70s. But it's also a timeless book. You know, so much of it yeah. still resonates today. So much of it is thoughtful and nuanced, and I think it's a work with enduring value.
Yeah, I think you said it better than I could. You know, just from a first-time read, this was a very enjoyable one and gave me lots to think about. I thought it was interesting. There's sometimes when I read a book of science fiction and I try and come up with comps for it, and some books just kind of evade that process where I wrote down five comps for this, and that weren't necessarily comps in the thematic way, the way yours were, or the structural way, but just about concepts that are in them that give you topics to discuss, topics to meditate about. And, you know, in that sense, this is definitely a strong recommend from me, just because it gives you so many things to think about in such a short book.
I find it so interesting that each of us came with comps with, and there was no overlap between what we would compare it to. And that's because it isn't just like anything else. Mm-hmm. There's nothing else on the Hugo winners list that's just like this. You know, one that keeps springing to mind, not from the novels list, but from short stories, is Connie Willis's The Last of the Winnebagoes. It has that same solemn mournfulness to it, that same elegiac poetry to it. But yeah, it is a totally unique novel.
Yeah. Well, as we're wrapping up here, where can people find you?
On Twitter, @Hugo_book_club. That's where most of the content I put out is found.
Okay.
Yeah, that's my main hobby.
Okay. And then the club itself is hugoclub.blogspot.ca?
It is the website. And, I mean, if you're at Worldcon, if Worldcon happens,
right?
I mean, I'll be around. I don't know if there will be any other Olavs there. I haven't seen anybody else with that first name on the list. And I'll be, again, doing the photography at the Masquerade and at the Hugo Awards. So doing cool portraits of all the authors and all of the competitors. So
nice.
If you see a guy with a camera wandering around who's bald and has a red beard, that is likely me.
Nice. Well, I know at least one of my other guests often goes to the Worldcon. I think Juan San Miguel said that he's been to every Worldcon for quite a number of years.
Oh, and he's really worth following on Twitter. He is he's a very astute reader of science fiction. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I've actually met him in person, but he's pretty awesome.
Yeah. Well, if you guys meet at the Worldcon, you'll have to take a selfie and send it to me on Twitter.
I'll do so, definitely.
All right. Well, Olav, thanks so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Yeah, it was nice because I had put out a request for people to pick some of the shorter ones so that I could get them recorded in advance. And you pretty quickly reached out to me because you had wanted to cover this one, I think, on a future episode after doing Deepness in the Sky. So I'm glad we got to do it.
Yeah, and I mean, I know Deepness in the Sky was a little bit short and a little bit of an easy read, so had to pick something a little...
Right. Absolutely. All right. Take care.
Take care. Cheers.
Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Olav. He's always a great guest. It was nice to have him back. This episode was recorded back in March, and it was one that I had planned on releasing to cover my sabbatical, but it turned out my sabbatical was mostly at home, so now I've just been putting those episodes out. So it's pretty much back to business as usual in terms of regular episodes for this podcast being one per month. I am going to start doing, and you will have already seen in the feed, a series on comfort reads, and it's not necessarily even going to be science fiction specific or fantasy specific. It's just going to be about reading and about comfort reading. So look for those kind of as interstitial episodes. And we'll do, you know, typical Hugo's There episodes at the beginning of each month. So again, thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do that in a number of ways. You can retweet, share with your friends, leave a rating in iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you find us. If you'd like to get a hold of me, feedback@hugospodcast.com is the email address. You can also go to hugospodcast.com and fill out the contact form, or you can tweet at me @hugospodcast. And if you'd like to sign up to support the podcast, you can do that on patreon.com/hugospodcast. Okay, that'll do it for this time. Thank you so much for listening. Talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Cuskey.